Government Finance
and Veterans Affairs Committee will come to order March 11th. Representative Earhart, House File 525 is first on the agenda. Representative Earhart, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think this is a first for us.
Well, I don't know if that's good or bad, Madam Chair.
Well, we'll see what happens. We don't know either, Representative Earhart, but we bet it's more good than bad.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd like to report you have a broken chair here.
Mr. Nash will take care of it and replace it.
Thank you.
Except you just sat in it.
It's on a part that doesn't bother the set.
I see. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'd like to have somebody move my bill.
Representative Earhart, I will move that House File 525 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Public Safety.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also have an amendment here, H.O. 525A1, and I'd appreciate someone moving that.
Representative Earhart, I move adoption of 525A1. Put the bill in the order that you want it to be, because you are the most important. Representative Earhart, what does this amendment do?
Well, this bill is about making...
What does the amendment do?
Excuse me?
What does the amendment do?
Oh, the amendment changes the main two lines in the bill on page 2. It replaces eligible to take with who passed the examination that we're going to be talking about. And it says on 2.6 after B eligible, it repeats itself. B eligible to be licensed as a peace officer.
Okay, it makes that sentence better. Is there any discussion on the amendment? All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Yes. Representative Earhart, please discuss 525 as amended.
All right, Madam Chair. I have with me Staff Sergeant Chris Geiger, who is 10-plus years in the military, now on active duty. And this is about his ability to take reciprocity examination based on relevant military experience for the police officers' test, and that means that he would like to take that test while he is on active duty, but he would not be eligible to become a peace officer until discharge. And so I would call on him to explain his feelings about that. Staff Sergeant Geiger, would you speak to that, please?
Yes, Representative Earhart. Madam Chair, I'm Staff Sergeant Chris Geiger. 27 years old. I've been in the Air Force 10-plus years. All of that, the last 7.5, roughly, have been active duty. All have been spent in the military, police, and the Air Force. Currently, as I said, as mentioned, I'm a staff sergeant. I'm also certified as a patrol supervisor, which duties entail keeping up on my patrols and what's going on base, being in charge and acting as a supervisor. I also have a bachelor's degree in law enforcement leadership from Metropolitan State. Associate's degree from the Community College of the Air Force in criminal justice, and I'm working on a graduate certificate in emergency management through American Military University. How this affects me personally is, as of right now, the states I have to get out of the military before I even attempt to take the police officer's licensing test to be eligible. This affects me also is because the Air Force is proposing to take away our aircraft and our mission, and with that I lose my job, and that affects roughly 60 personnel on the base. And I know at least 5 to 10 people that this state law affects that are hindering them from taking the test to possibly become police officers. It'll bring With this, if it passes and gets this changed, it'll bring skills that we learn in the military to the local law enforcement, and it'll help bring a more qualified and diverse pool of applicants to the state law enforcement.
Yep. Sergeant Geiger, how will you take your peace officers' training?
The way it is, Madam Chair, is there's a reciprocity. If you've been in the military, active duty in a military police specialty for 5 years, they waive the skills portion because we're already trained in the skills by doing the job. So this test will be on Minnesota laws and statutes governing law enforcement in the state.
And Sergeant Geiger, then, and the current law, though it allows you to take your training or get your training approved because you're 5 years experience, they don't allow you to take the test while you're still in the military.
Yes, ma'am.
Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Ms. Bjornberg, from the Post Board.
Yes.
Yeah. Peace Officers, Board of Police Officers Standards and Training. Do you have a comment to make on this?
Yes, Madam Chair and committee members. I am Mary Bjornberg from the Post Board, and I am the Continuing Education Coordinator. House File 525 was reviewed by Post Board and staff members, and everyone supports the amended language. Also, February 19th, Neil Melton, our Executive Director, testified at the Senate in support of the their companion bill.
Just as you're testifying today.
Yes, I'm here today for Neil Melton.
Ms. Bjornberg, will this give the veterans a step up?
Madam Chair, committee members, absolutely. Right now, what we do is they have to show their DD-214, showing that they were honorably discharged from the military before we would let them sit for the exam. What this change will do is let them sit for the exam before they're honorably discharged, and then once they're honorably discharged, they would then show us their documents, but they would already have taken the exam.
Okay. All right. Representative Earhart, anything more?
Nothing more for me.
Questions? Chair. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for my tardiness, but I just have one quick question regarding post-certification. And if you've already covered this, my apologies. Well, there may be a gap in military service versus Minnesota law. How is that gap being made up as far as statute and compliance with Minnesota's criminal code and different kinds of things that officers would need to be aware of that would not have otherwise had that exposure or training because of military experience?
Ms. Bjornberg.
Madam Chair, committee members, there are rules right now that they have to have at least 5 years in the military before they can take the test, and they would have to have that experience.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do respect and understand that these are seasoned professionals that are coming, but as it applies to Minnesota state law and the nuance, is that someone who might come through a traditional training program to be a law enforcement officer in the state of Minnesota, how is that gap going to be made up that maybe military but Minnesota specific statutes, highway enforcement, criminal code, what are felonies, how to deal with those types of things in Minnesota criminal code?
Ms. Bjornberg.
Yes. Madam Chair, committee members, the reciprocity exam is has different questions and whatnot for their training, and so when they take the exam, there's also study guides for them so that they would know what would be stipulated for the exam, so that would help them to be able to pass the exam.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. One last question. Is there an exam preparation class that's available for those individuals who might not have gone through one of the technical schools or other formalized training in the state of Minnesota so that they could, in a classroom environment, seek clarification of the stuff that's in the written handbooks?
Ms. Bjornberg.
Madam Chair, committee members, there is a guide for reciprocity exam, people that want to take the exam. There's not actually a training for them, but there is a guide that they can get at the Minnesota bookstore and they can study from.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Final comment, and it's not a question. I do support our military members having this privilege. I just want to make sure that we're putting them in the best case scenario for success in this situation and not trying to put any kind of roadblocks to keep them competitive with those who may have gained other experiences, education, and knowledge through formalized training that might not have been provided in the military experience.
Ms. Bjornberg.
Madam Chair, committee members, we have for the people that have taken the military exam, they have passed the exam, and there has been no problems in the past.
So the experience that you've had in the past, it's a satisfactory, studying the manual is a satisfactory, leads to satisfactory passage of the test.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And if everybody would look on line 1.22 and 1.23, it states that has been honorably discharged from the military active service as evident by a form, DD-214. I would think it would be best to have the most recent DD-214. So I would suggest just a couple of words change here. If I would address, probably should read the service as evidence of the most recent DD-214. Because I know in the military we get several DD-214s based on our deployments and so forth. I think the most recent DD-214 should probably be the one that would indicate an honorable discharge. Would the author be agreeable to that?
Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair, Representative Dittner, I think there's also a place on the back, 2.6, or is that one you were talking about? There's a couple of places where they reference 1.23 and 2.6, where they also reference DD-214.
Yeah, that would be, would need to make the change in both locations, yes.
Mr. Shepard, comment?
Madam Chair, I think that works, and I will write it up and give it to Ms. Melander.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All in favor of the Detmer oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Any further comments? Okay. So, Ms. Bjornberg, this book or that you can buy at the bookstore that brings you up brings a Sergeant Geiger up to Minnesota wisdom on this post board expectations. They can acquire this book as soon as they anticipate that they're going to be 5 years in the military and they want to start studying for their COPS license?
Madam Chair, yes, they can. It includes Minnesota Criminal Code, Traffic Code, and Juvenile Justice Laws, which is part of the exam, and they can purchase that at the Minnesota bookstore at any time if they know that they are going to take that exam.
And so they could study it for a long period of time?
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, I'll renew my motion to move 525 as amended and amended and sent to Committee on Public Safety. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you very much, Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members.
Next item on the agenda, Representative Sanders, House File 591. Representative Sanders, I will move that House File 591 be recommended to pass.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, committee members.
It's good to be in front of you today with House File 591. What this bill does is deal with vacancy and nominations for partisan offices. This bill went through the Elections Committee, which I see several members of that committee is on this committee, where we dealt with kind of any foreseeable reasons we could with having a partisan vacancy in nomination. One example is if a candidate dies after the withdrawal period, or similarly, we had a situation this past election cycle where we had a vacancy from a member from Duluth that was allowed off the ballot due to a state Supreme Court case, which kind of surprised everyone. So we needed to have some guidelines situated in statute that would tell us what we should do as a state if we end up with a partisan vacancy and nomination. Worked with Ms. Beth Frazier at the Secretary of State's office, and we think that we came up with pretty much the best solution you can have to a bad situation if you do. But this timeline allows us to, in my opinion, preserve as much access and integrity in the election process that we can. So if there are technical questions, Ms. Beth Frazier is here to assist me in answering those. The reason we're in front of you is due to the fiscal notes and the appropriation that would go to the Secretary of State if there is a statewide recount in that or special election. The Secretary of State's office would then and only then receive an appropriation from the state to help cover those costs. With that, Madam Chair, we'll stand for any questions.
Ms. Frazier, you want to tell us a little more about why I would think this bill is okay?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Beth Frazier from the Office of the Secretary of State. And as Representative Sanders explained, we are working on what to do in the case of a partisan candidate who is due to be on the general election ballot, but either dies, becomes incapacitated, or withdraws during the withdrawal period. And the reason the bill is in front of your committee is that because of several laws that have changed, we're no longer able to do what we did when Senator Wellstone died in 2002. In that case, we got the name of a candidate at the last minute and photocopied, made ballots on the photocopier and handed them out to voters. And that's no longer an option under several federal laws, including laws that require that ballots be accessible for people with disabilities, which requires programming of equipment, and that ballots not be just printed on photocopiers because they can't be read by the accessible voting equipment. Also, the Federal Military and Overseas Voter Empowerment Act requires that absentee ballots be sent to military and overseas voters at least 46 days before the election, which would preclude, at least in the case of a federal election, changing the names of candidates at the last minute. And so in the case of a candidate who dies or becomes incapacitated after the general election ballots have been printed, this bill calls for a special election in that case. Basically, the election in November would effectively, for that race, be canceled. The votes would not be counted, and there would be a special election in February. And the bill says that in the case of a statewide special election, so for U.S. Senate or governor or one of the other constitutional officers, for example, that there would that the local election officials and the Office of the Secretary of State would be reimbursed for the cost of running that special election. Not in the case of a congressional special or legislative special, but only in the case of a statewide special. Because we hope that this never happens, and because there's only been one circumstance in the past many decades that would have caused this had this law been in effect, the fiscal note reflects a zero appropriation for the foreseeable future. But were that to occur, it provides for the funding. And the estimate of a statewide special election is about $3 million.
So, Ms. Frazier, how do you anticipate if indeed this did happen and we did have to have a statewide, then where would the $3 million come from?
Madam Chair and members, the bill has an open appropriation from the general fund for that contingency.
After the fact?
Yes, Madam Chair.
So I'm still a little unclear, Ms. Fraser and Mr. Representative Sanders, on what if the situation exists, like when Senator Wellstone died? Then what do we do about the election? Because there's certainly not 40 days.
Right.
Representative Sanders.
So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think we have some handouts that kind of address the timeline that we can get to you as well. And I guess it should be in your packet, hopefully.
Is that the
yes.
vacancy in nomination for partisan candidates?
Yes, Madam Chair, and on the back page, it kind of walks you through what would happen. And we spent, even before the session started, a bipartisan working group working on this and a nonpartisan vacancy and nomination as well, and mapped these out as much as we could with the withdrawal period. It's a very technical timeline, obviously lots of things, lots of moving parts with dates. But what would happen then is if death withdrawal happened on or before the 79th day before the general election, that party would be able to name a candidate's replacement for the general election ballot, and then you would have a special election after that November election, at which time you would actually have the election for that race that would be for that statewide race that would be that had the original vacancy and nomination.
Okay. Ms. Fraser, then, is that the election that would cost $3 million?
Madam Chair and members, a statewide special election would cost approximately $3 million, yes.
So, Representative Sanders, you're telling us that a nonpartisan committee or a committee with Democrats and Republicans worked on this in the interim and then came to the Elections Committee with this proposal?
Madam Chair, yes. There were several members that met with the Secretary of State's office during the interim once we had this. And there was another scenario that we met with as well over non-partisan offices. We had a situation where a candidate for non-partisan office actually passed away after the withdrawal period as well during this last election cycle. So very timely issues that obviously there's a lot of moving parts, not only with the dates and withdrawal periods and that, but you have primaries and election dates and a lot of different things that happen in accordance with state law based upon those timelines. So, yes, we did work in a group to try and make sure that we foresaw as much as we could so that we won't have to be back here again with legislation to move any of these targets. Hopefully we've covered everything.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon was involved in the discussions, as was Senator Rest and Senator Newman, and representatives of both the Republican Party of Minnesota and the Democratic Farmer Labor Party of Minnesota were also involved in the discussion in coming up with these.
Representative Simon, did your committee recommend 591 to this committee to be passed?
Yes, Madam Chair, it did. And might I say, I'm sorry I'm late here, but in terms of the money, it's really kind of a phantom amount. There is no amount that would come from our target here. It's all speculative. But in the future, we are saying that I kept using, and I'm sorry I missed the beginning, Representative Sanders, but I always use the 2002 sort of Wellstone example. This is basically that situation, where instead of doing what we did in 2002, which is we had the election with a last-minute candidate, Walter Mondale in that case, now we would say, forevermore, if that happened, we would just not do that election that November. We would postpone it until February, and we'd have a special election then. Okay. So that's the cost.
And in the other situation that Representative Sanders mentioned, the Duluth situation this summer where there was time, then this bill says that the party will choose the candidate.
Well, it depends when the withdrawal period would happen. there might be some circumstance which and some date after which the party would not be able to put a candidate in. And the reason we had to come up with a cutoff date is I think all the parties involved realized that, well, remember, with the situation that happened with the Duluth area legislator, there was a Supreme Court case that came out of that. And the Supreme Court actually said that there are no standards in there for when or under what circumstances someone can withdraw. So we have the situation now where if we didn't do anything this year, one could imagine a situation where a particular local political party unit could game the system. What happens if there's a particularly hot race and party X's candidate is doing really poorly in October and they just withdraw for that reason because the polls are bad? They could do that. The Supreme Court basically said they could do that. So we had to have a hard deadline beyond which you couldn't fill in the blank. That's why.
So Madam Chair and
Ms. Fraser
and members, this bill would actually preclude what happened in Duluth this past summer. It would say if a candidate changes his or her mind, they're allowed to do that during the two-day withdrawal period following the filing period. But after that point, they are the candidate and will be on the ballot unless there is a death or unless they contract a incapacitating illness that two doctors certify will make them permanently and continuously incapacitated.
Two doctors.
Madam Chair, yes. That follows a section that's in current law.
Gee, I wonder if the health exchange... I won't go there. I won't go there.
You can, Madam Chair, just ask we pass this bill first.
We'll try to help you all, Representative Sanders. Any further discussion? All in favor of the motion to that House File 5591 be recommended to people to pass and be placed on the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Oh, gee. Better.
Next on the agenda, members of the committee, is House File 819. Representative Murphy, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Murphy, please go ahead and present your bill.
I move that House File 819 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Environment, Natural Resources, and Agriculture Finance Committee.
And could you discuss the bill with the committee,
please?
This
is a bill which reorganizes the public facilities grants, makes them a few more people eligible, and changes some of the criteria by which the grants are awarded. Mr. Freeman from the Public Facilities Authority can tell you a lot more.
Mr. Freeman, if you'd like to give us your name for the record and address the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the director of the Public Facilities Authority. I think in your packets you should have a one-page handout that summarizes the points of the bill. Public Facilities Authority provides financing to local governments for water infrastructure projects. Most of that is done through our revolving loan funds. This bill makes some changes to some of the grant programs that we have, specifically or primarily the programs that are funded through the Clean Water Legacy Act. There's the first two programs that are on the handout are both the Total Maximum Daily Load Grant Program and the Phosphorus Reduction Grant Program were created in 2005 and 2006 to provide additional funding, 50% grants, when a city is required through its permit to provide some additional level of treatment over and above what it would otherwise have to do in order to meet a specific water quality goal. And this was done through one program that was directed at when a TMDL study is done that triggers those permit requirements to address an impaired water, to restore an impaired water. And then a separate program was created for phosphorus reduction when a city has a permit requirement to provide additional phosphorus treatment to protect a threatened water body. There's an awful lot of overlap between those two programs, and so the one thing that this bill does would be to merge those two into one program and streamline and simplify that process for cities. And then it takes one step further and basically says anytime a city is required through its permit to provide additional levels of treatment above and beyond what it would otherwise have to do, a city can access these grant funds to help pay for that project. What it'll do essentially is allow cities to get access these funds sooner, build these projects more quickly, rather than waiting for the whole TMDL process to play out in some cases, which can take up to a 10-year cycle. So it'll allow these projects to move forward more quickly and streamline the process for everyone. Also, there's some changes to the small community program, which focuses on very small, generally 20 to 30 households or fewer, small rural unsewered communities where there are problems with failing septics and they can't be fixed through private owners fixing their own septics, generally because the lots are too small or the soils are bad. So this program tries to help those communities. There's a technical assistance grant component and then construction funding. We'd like to raise the cap on the technical assistance grants and involve counties, make them eligible to receive some of these funds to help figure out what to do for those small communities, and then raise the cap on the construction funding to better address the kinds of projects that we're seeing, which are typically cluster drain fields and mound systems. Finally, the bill addresses a glitch in one of our other programs, the Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program, which provides supplemental assistance to package with our revolving fund loans for high-cost hardship communities. Generally, when costs get above $50 a month or so per household, that program has been or was a grant program from when it was first created in the mid-90s to 2005. And then at that point, it switched for a few years to a deferred loan program and then switched back again to grants in 2011. What we'd like to do to kind of a fairness or equity situation, take the current grant criteria and apply it back to the 16 projects that receive those deferred loans, and to the extent that they'd be eligible for grants now under the current program, convert those deferred loans to grants so they're on more of a level playing field with other communities that are currently receiving this funding. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Are there any questions? Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, I believe I'm just trying to get squared away on a couple of things that I've been reading here. And the TMDL program and the phosphorus reduction program, and I can't get my finger on it where I read that it's going to be renamed to a point source. And my question then is, will this include a community, a city's capability to have stormwater, like, you know, off of roads and whatnot, these ponds that we have, you know, a lot of them around our lakes now, they're, you know, so that stormwater is not going into the regular stormwater catchment. and into the sewer treatment system. It's being, you know, held up in a pond. Are those still going to be able to be part of this?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell. Thank you for pointing that out. I forgot to mention that we are proposing a name change because it's no longer just TMDLs that we're addressing. Point source implementation grants make imply it's a little bit bigger than that. But you are absolutely correct that in addition to wastewater treatment, there are stormwater permit requirements that cities are required to meet under the TMDL process, and those projects will be eligible, are eligible for these grant funds. We've done a few of those to date. We anticipate that there will be more in the future as stormwater and the pollution control agency's impaired water process kind of ramps up and focuses more on stormwater in the future. There will be more of those projects that will be able to access these funds.
Representative
Purcell. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up, because the term point source versus non-point source is what's got me in. And some coming off a street is a non-point source, at least generically speaking. I don't know if it's in statute. So that's what caught my eye about, are the cities still going to be able to do that kind of thing if you rename it point source?
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, point source refers to it's a regulated discharge under the PCA permit. There are cities that have stormwater permits, and it's regulated. It's different than a wastewater permit, but it is regulated as a point source discharge, and so it does fall within that.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions? If not, Representative Murphy, we do have one. Representative Wells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question in the changes, and maybe you mentioned it, but maybe if you could highlight and explain further. How will this affect the legacy funds that you receive right now?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the three programs currently, TMDL grants, phosphorus reduction grants, and small community program, that are all three right now funded through appropriations from the Clean Water Legacy Funds to the Public Facilities Authority. So it's the slice of those funds that are directed at municipalities for wastewater and stormwater implementation projects. So there's no appropriation with this bill. That's done through the budget bill, but this bill will change those programs a little bit to make them work better.
Okay. And Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy.
Representative Wills, this bill will end up in Legacy Finance Committee.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? If not, Representative Murphy, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I would. I move that House File 819 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, and Agriculture Finance.
Good. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bill passes.
Thank you.
Okay. Who's next? 1241. Yeah. Representative Demers. That's a good question.
Representative Detmer. Community Safety Personnel Training, House File 1241.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I move House File 1241 to pass, and I'm assuming, Madam Chair, that would go to Public Safety.
That's from correct. Representative Detmer moves that House File 1241 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. House File 1241, basically it appropriates some funds to the Commissioner of Public Safety for a grant for the Upper Midwest Community Policy Institute for the use and training community safety personnel about the use of de-escalation strategies for handling returning veterans. And as we know, the past 10 years or so, we've had a lot of veterans coming back from the front, from either Iraq or Afghanistan, and multiple tours. And our public safety personnel in the Minnesota do go through training to how you deal with some of these members of our armed forces that are having some problems. And with me today, I have three individuals that would like to address this issue. They brought it to my attention. And we have Bob Boone, Wayne Shellum, and Trista Masta Castile.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Wayne Shellum. I'm a director with the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute. We're a nonprofit in Woodbury, Minnesota.
In where?
Woodbury.
Thank you.
My 4 years with them, I was a retired police officer, 32 years. I retired as the police chief in the city of Robbinsdale. And have been, as I said, with the Institute for about 4 years. I've included an executive summary of our effort within your packet. As I said, we're a 501 C3, and we have extensive experience in a lot of areas. We at the Institute, we currently hold grants. And I have a grant from the Department of Justice, Bureau of Justice Assistance in training judges, prosecutors, officers, and human trafficking task forces in the crime of human trafficking across the country. We also have a grant that from the COPS Office and the Department of Justice. We do extensive training in Indian Country and on supervision and community policing, and we're in about the fifth year of that grant. I go into a little bit more about us, but one of the grants that we currently have is a grant called Public Safety De-escalation Tactics for Veterans in Crisis. That particular grant is a federal grant that we have been challenged with. We're the only one in the country that's doing it. And is funding from the COPS office in Washington. We take this one-day class throughout the country, and because it's a federal grant, we have to we really are directed to certain spots around the country. We've been to Fayetteville, North Carolina, San Antonio, Seattle, and I could go on, but we only have about 15 grants. And that particular grant is coming to a close, but as a result, it's something that is in great demand in the state of Minnesota, and we've done a pilot. Our first pilot for that grant was done about a year ago in Lakeville, Minnesota, and we had folks from Lakeville and Eagan and Apple Valley and the officers and public safety personnel from there. And that particular grant is nearing the end, but we've had great demand for this training throughout the state, and for reasons known all too well to you, training money and training budgets around the state for county sheriff's offices and police departments are very, very thin and in some cases non-existent. So want to bring this training to the state, and I'll kind of end it there, and I'd like to have one of my cohorts here introduce himself.
Mr. Boone.
Madam Chair, Bob Boone, and I'd like to just start off today by thanking the committee. As I look around, I see people that I served with. I'm a 38-year veteran of the Army, and my last two assignments were to be the 34th Red Bull Division Command Sergeant Major, and then I moved on to be the State Command Sergeant Major for the state of Minnesota. Retired in 2007 with 38 years of service, and since then have dedicated a large portion of my time to continue to serve members of our society who have worn the uniform. and that meant a very active involvement in the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon effort, and I do chair that for Isani County, and we just sent a unit out of our armory, the 850th Horizontal Engineers, for a year in Afghanistan. But above and beyond that, Wayne gave me a call and said, Bob, would you like to come to work for us as a consultant and a trainer for a course we're putting together to try to help those first responder type folks, public safety people, understand some tactics, techniques, and procedures that they could use in interfacing with members of our armed forces, veterans who, you know, might be struggling. And I said, gladly. And I've had the opportunity to travel this great nation and see the response we have given. A couple of months ago, I asked Wayne, I said, Wayne, we need to really think about, can we take this to the state of Minnesota? Can we do what we're doing on a federal level in the state? And thus we came to Representative Detmer's office, and he has helped us along the way to bring us to today. And with your approval, we'll continue down this path and be able to take some very valuable training to those folks in Minnesota who are on the cutting edge of seeing veterans as they struggle. They're probably the next closest person to the families who meets up with a veteran who needs a little bit of assistance. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank Wayne? You. Mr. Shellam, the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute, what states does that serve?
Madam Chair, thank you, and members of the committee. We actually received federal money, and as a result, all of our programs have to be nationwide applicable. Specifically, our training in Minnesota is for example, for the last 10 years, I have personally trained over, I tried to think, about 500 investigators in the instance of internal affairs. We have extensive training in that. We have training throughout the state in school resource officers and various other things. So we concentrate on state issues, but we also address national issues as well.
Mr. Shellam, in what states do you train people for the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute?
Madam Chair, I could list almost every state that we actually do training in. When we concentrate in Indian Country, we travel all over the country. We trained in from Maine to Florida to Arizona to Alaska, and in fact, tomorrow Sergeant Major is going to join our other instructor, and we're going to train the public safety de-escalation tactics for veterans in crisis in Manoman on the White Earth Indian Reservation, and we're hosted by White Earth, and that audience is tribal. And we're concentrating on the tribal law enforcement officers and have them attend there. So while we are locally, we provide technical assistance. We've worked with the City of Albert Lea, Centennial Lakes Police Department, recently did an assessment at Metro Transit Police. And so we are very well known in the state of Minnesota because of our internal affairs training and of our assessments and various other training programs that we've done.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Trista Mattis Castillo, Chair of the Women Veterans Initiative, and I'm here on behalf to support this bill and excited to add that we, the Women Veterans Initiative, are eager to collaborate on this training. So what's new and unique for Minnesota is that we're collaborating and adding the women veterans perspective. So in this training moving forward, we're developing curriculum with the Upper Midwest Policing Institute to address issues for women veterans as well and the uniquenesses of women veterans. So on behalf of our 23,000 women veterans, we're eager to support this bill as well.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Depper, for your pursuits and diligence in bringing these things forward. That's much appreciated. It's been going on a long time, and we just got to keep working at it. I have one question. I don't know how the answer might come out, but if you have an incident that comes up and in this training you're doing, how easy is it for peace officers to identify that individual is a veteran?
Mr. Shellum.
Madam Chair committee members, that is part of the training. What we noticed in the national training that we've done is that curriculum was written in 2011, and we've learned a lot going across the country, and where it may be tweaked and need other things to be addressed. And one of the things that we found is that in order to make this Minnesota specific, we've really had some lessons learned, and one of them is how do you identify a vet, and how do you where do you go, and as far as first line officers and deputies, how do you recognize? And that's one of the things, another module that we're going to modify significantly for the state of Minnesota. And we have retired Gunnery Sergeant John Baker, who some of you I'm sure know, has got a real good module and is going to help us with that specifically to identify a veteran.
Just a quick follow up, and I'm thinking as you're talking here, because I'm trying to figure this out too. Been through quite a bit of stuff like this in my time working with other veterans, and it just seems like, you know, these county veteran service officers and their relationship with the sheriff's departments right there, oftentimes they're in the same building, might be just a good way to go. But that just come to mind.
Mr. Shellum.
Madam Chair, thank you. The other thing that we learned is a good segue, is that what we're planning on doing and what will be a critical part of the curriculum is to make contact with and invite every county veteran service officer to this training. Also, we're going to invite the local family assistance center to attend this training as well, and to make that connection, because one of the things that we really noticed throughout the nation is that there's not that connection. There's resources and the availability resources for law enforcement officers and their knowledge of veterans issues, quite frankly, is not very strong. There's not a lot of the younger officers now, and I speak from my experience, that ever have been in the military. My experience is 6 years in the Guard. I was in 70 to 76 with the first of the 151. And while not on active duty, that has been my experience. And we found that there's just a lot of officers and deputies out there that don't have any idea what's available to veterans, let alone the awareness of our women veterans issues, which are huge, and nobody really knows about them. So that's another major module that we're going to address, and we do it on a national level now, but we think we can do a lot better job in the state of Minnesota with the resources and everything associated with, as Trista said, the women's issues, because that's not being addressed across the nation. I'll tell you that right now. And we have been in Minnesota on the cutting edge with the Yellow Ribbon Campaign. I'm proud to go to, as I say, everywhere from Seattle to Florida, and to talk about the Yellow Ribbon Campaign and what it is, and virtually everybody across the nation knows that it originated right here. And we want to take the current course, which is really a great course and does a lot about communication, but we want to take that course and we want to take it to the next level, and we want to do it in our state. And so those are some of the ways that we are going to do that.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Detmer, I'm reading this, and I got a little bit paused when they talked about that the Upper Midwest Community Policing goes to all the states. What guarantee do we have, I guess, that this money is going to be spent in Minnesota and not in Florida or Alaska or someplace else? And I don't know if there's language we could put in there. Mr. Shepard might be able to help me with that, so that we know that this money is spent here, because other than the line 1.14 where it says throughout the state of Minnesota, there's nothing that says this money has to be spent here. And if this group is throughout the state, throughout multiple states, I don't want to see our money going someplace else and training officers.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Representative Nelson, I think we have the answer here. So,
Mr. Shalom.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, yes. We had, in 2009, we received a grant from the Office of Justice Programs here in the state of Minnesota to do an awareness level of veterans issues and community reaction to veterans. That grant was administered through the Office of Justice Programs here in the state. When we hopefully get the funding, we would work through the Office of Justice Programs, and they would administer, and they would have oversight of where we go. We would submit all of our locations to the Office of Justice Programs. They would monitor every single one of our trainings, and we would report to them after every single training and prior to going anywhere, but we would stay in the state. The other thing is that the UMCPI is in the same building as the Minnesota Sheriff's Association and the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. We would work, and we've already been in contact and talked extensively with the two executive directors. We would use their regional rep programs and their regions to go to the state. There's 9 regions essentially in the state between the two of them. We would go to each region at least 4 times, and we would work with the chiefs and the sheriffs and work within those regions, all under the auspices of the Office of Justice Programs. Incidentally, we would make this all post certified. We are one of a few in the state of Minnesota that are authorized by the Post Board to grant our own continuing education credits, and to that end, we report to the Post Board as well. So, post credits are no problem with this, because we can take care of that. We would stay within the state.
Representative Nelson.
I guess that didn't answer my question. I said there's nothing in the bill here, Representative Detmer, that says this money would have to be spent in Minnesota. And I guess so that's the question of Mr. Shepard, or has an answer there where we could insert that. I'd like to put that in. That would give me some comfort, because our money's not going. And while he's doing that, or before he's doing that, you can think about this. How did you pick the $100,000, the dollar amount? But I'll let them go first.
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson.
Representative Detmer.
I think, we agree that we can put that language in there, Mr. Cleary. And the $100,000 amount per year, or $200,000 for the biennium, was brought to me from the organization.
And was that based on the study from the Office of Justice grant program?
Madam Chair, essentially...
Mr. Shalom.
Thank you. Essentially, it was... We took that money and we came across a figure on how many trainings we could do over a 2-year period, and what it would take to get it done, and how many people we could reach. And I hesitate to say it was an arbitrary figure, but it's like what is a fair figure, and what what do we think that we realistically can do, and how many people can we reach?
And the tribes, tribal governments are also part of this.
Madam Chair, yes, that we will train and we'll work with, and we've got already requests from many of the tribes for this training, as well as I was on the phone to Ramsey County an hour and a half ago, and they want the training. Jim Beauregard, the chief of Morris Police Department, I talked to him 2 days ago, and he was asking how we can get the training, along with, I could name at least 10 other police chiefs that have contacted me about this training. And
well, probably the next committee will go into much more depth on that than we will, but these were regular questions. Mr. Cleary.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Nelson and members, I consulted a bit with Mr. Shepherd here. I think we could handle your concern pretty simply by adding a couple of words at the end of line 1.9, simply in Minnesota, so that it would read, for a grant to the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute for use in training community safety personnel in Minnesota about the such and such. And if you like, we could put a couple of words at the end of line 1.14, to ensure that the training opportunities are reasonably distributed throughout the state of Minnesota. And of course, Representative Nelson, in the end, it's up to the commissioner to ensure that that money is used where it's supposed to be.
Representative Detmer.
Representative Detmer, will you include that in your...
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, good point. I would like to include that.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the amendment, I know where we're going with that. I might just suggest a modification to that. Instead of saying training community safety personnel in Minnesota, that we address that to be licensed personnel in the state of Minnesota. But we could have a national convention that's hosted in Minnesota that we may be spending money on, and you would have met that definition as proposed.
Very good point.
Madam Chair and Representative Driscoll, that might be a problem for first responders,
dispatchers.
That might be a problem with those people that might want to take the course. Are there any other people?
Community yes. Service officers.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Shellam.
I think. When we talk about public safety personnel, one of the things that immediately came to mind was we're in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and a dispatcher was there and attending the class. In fact, we had virtually all of their dispatchers there except one who was working, and she was married to an operator out of Fort Bragg, and she told stories about how she is getting to be an expert on plastering walls and things like that, and it was very emotional, and that brought the women's issues to light, along with the fact that we do have a video that we talk about dispatchers, and we think that they need to know, and flags need to be raised when they talk to somebody that's calling in a domestic. So, for example, so. We encourage their participation in the training, as well as EMS. I've had a number of EMS folks come up and talk about, geez, you know, we would like to go to this training as well. So that's why we called it public safety, in that we would open it up. First of all, first and foremost, is for law enforcement deputies and officers that are first responders. But we also would open it up and have, in fact, in our Lakeville pilot, we had two police chaplains. The new chaplain for the National Guard, the new priest, is actually a friend of mine. And when I approached him, he said, I'd love to go to the training too. So that's the only issue, I think, with it.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Understood. How would the, and I would defer to Messrs. Clary and Shepard for this, but if we were to go with language that was somewhat similar to agencies and entities charged with public safety in the state of Minnesota, would that resolve the question?
Very well put.
Or Mr. Clary?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, may I ask you to repeat that, please?
Certainly, Mr. Clary. Madam Chair?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Using the phrasing, not exactly where it would end up in the text of the amendment, but agencies and entities charged with public safety in Minnesota.
Madam Chair?
Representative.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair?
Why don't you address that?
Madam Chair, I'd just like to address that, Representative O'Driscoll. The problem with that is that in this training, the part that we're going to add support for women veterans, many of those first responders that we'd like to also train are not necessarily just public safety. So, for instance, if there is a issue of sexual assault or domestic assault related, then our first responders might indeed be organizations through MnCASA or the sexual assault or even nurses in the hospital as well that we'd like to address, and that's the uniqueness of the women veterans issue.
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, and we were talking up here, you whispered in my ear, I think, on line 1.19, instead of in Minnesota, if we just put after training, insert Minnesota there, so we're training Minnesota community service personnel, and that would take care of the issue about in Minnesota, that these are going to be Minnesota training personnel, I think.
No,
that would work better.
Totally got
something.
Mr. Clary?
Yes, Representative Nelson, that sounds excellent. And Representative O'Driscoll, I wonder if we could handle your concern by simply adding principally that audience that you mentioned.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Madam Chair, I didn't have a problem with the original language. I was trying to partner with Representative Nelson to try to find a word that would, or a phrasing that would help us to get, as Representative Davis likes to say, peace in the valley on issues. So.
I'm not sure we're in the valley, but. The idea of this committee, and your motion is to send it on to public safety, but our concern is that Minnesotans be trained and that in whatever aspect of public safety they are trying to do. Yeah. So the last proposal that Representative Nelson made might make it clear enough.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would agree with that. Yeah, that's...
after Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute for use in training Minnesota community safety personnel. And then keep the line 1.14 of Minnesota at the end.
That's right.
That's your motion, Representative Detmer?
Madam Chair, that's my motion,
right.
Yes.
Any other questions? If not, Representative Detmer renews his motion that House File 1241 as...
Mr. Shepard.
Oh, Mr. Shepard.
Oh, Madam Chair, excuse me. I think to just be parliamentarily correct, you need to vote on the amendment that Representative Detmer suggested.
Oh,
just
okay.
To reflect that.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Yeah. The amendment is adopted. So,
Madam Chair, I did want to make a comment on the bill itself, and I will be brief with my comments.
Sure. We're on time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to just let members know that if you vote for this today, you are voting for an outstanding need in our state of Minnesota. I am very actively involved statewide in the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon Community Program and very actively involved in the Warrior to Citizen Program in central Minnesota. And I have occasion to meet with the Stearns County Chiefs of Police Association. And in December of 2011, I asked this very question. question of them. I said, how are you doing with de-escalation and working with veterans upon return? And could you use some help and some training in that? And without fail, every hand went up and some stories started coming forward about this. We attempted through our Warrior to Citizen and Beyond the Yellow Ribbon community limited resources that we have to try to be able to provide education and training for those folks. If you vote for this and we get this appropriation, it will be money that will be well spent in every one of our communities across the state of Minnesota, because the members of our armed forces are from every community across the state of Minnesota. It's not the large departments or cities of Minneapolis where they may have more resources. It may be the small town, one in two officers in a community that will end up having to deal on the front lines with these de-escalation issues. We owe it to the veterans, we owe it to their families, and we owe it to law enforcement to support them. And when the question came up, where do we come up with a $100,000 appropriation, I thought that was kind of light myself, knowing what the need is out there.
Mr. Shalom, does this also include mental health training?
Madam Chair, it certainly could. Although our training does, we do discuss PTSD and TBI and various other mental health issues. We make it a point to say you're not going to leave here as a clinical psychologist, and our training also is not for SWAT members and hostage negotiators. I say that as being about a 10-year hostage negotiator myself for a SWAT team in my previous life. But yes, we do discuss health issues and mental health issues at enough of a extent that officers are aware of it.
Representative Kahn?
I apologize for being late. I was at a meeting at the University of Minnesota facing a big fat clock that I was looking at all the time that hadn't been turned ahead. It never occurred to me to challenge it. And I never looked at my own clock. But anyway, what I just want to ask, because I want to ask, is this for the recently returning veterans? Is this for any veteran?
I believe it's for any.
Madam Chair, yes, it's for any veteran.
Well, I'm not going to do an... Madam Chairman, I really think that that's inappropriate. I really think, for example, there are veterans, Vietnam veterans and Korean veterans, I think, who are very well off, and they ought not be eligible on this. I've really thought that these kinds of programs, particularly when we use the language returning veterans, I really think that they ought to be targeted towards the post-9/11 veterans. So...
Representative Kahn, I don't think we're talking about money going to the veterans. This is going to the safety officers in Minnesota to be trained.
Well, the question is, what is the program designed to help? And I really think.
Representative Detmer.
Madam Chair, the program is designed to help our safety officer, yes, safety personnel, I should say, to deal with veterans that have had multiple deployments. It could be from any era with any type of psychological behaviors or problems that they might and might have, whether they're male or female.
Any further discussion? If not, Representative Detmer renews his motion that House File 1241 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety Finance.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, anybody can be a co-author on this bill, so 1241. Thank you.
Thank you. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? This motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Mariani. Representative Mariani. House File 764.
I think we can look at
welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And Madam Chair, I guess it would be appropriate for someone to provide a motion, since I can't do that at this point.
I will move House File 764 be recommended to pass and for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'm excited to have this bill presented before you, and I won't be speaking long because I'm going to have our guest, our testifier, basically do the share of sharing with you what this is about. But members, very quickly, this is a one-time sort of bridge funding, if you will, request to help keep alive a program that's been around for a little while, but can certainly use some state assistance while it moves into a more stable finance future. This program involves a one-on-one reading mentoring program for students that matches state employees who donate their time to interact and mentor low-income students. And I have a distinguished Minnesotan, Mr. Marvin Anderson, who was the founder of the program and operates the program, who will share with you the nature of the program. Mr. Anderson served for 22 years, members, as our state law librarian appointed by the Minnesota Supreme Court to that position. And if you go to the state law library, if you go to their rare books room, you will notice that the room is named in his honor, the Marvin R. Anderson Special Collections Room. I share that to let you know that we have a Minnesotan here who has given a lifetime of serving the public and continues to do that now in his retirement. In doing that by being able to connect state employees with area low-income students in a way that makes a powerful difference in their lives. And so with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Mr. Anderson to share with you and committee members his story and the nature of the program.
Mr. Anderson, welcome to the committee. We are honored to have you here with us.
Madam Chairman and Representative Mariani and members of the committee, it's a wonderful pleasure to be back testifying before a committee of the Minnesota Legislature. I had that wonderful privilege to do so when I was at the State Law Library for at least 10 times. And it was always an exciting moment for me to come before a committee and testify, and I couldn't wait to get out. And thank you very much for those words, Representative Mariani. When we start our volunteers, Madam Chairman and members of the committee, we paraphrase from them some words that were spoken that 20 years from now, it won't matter how many awards that I have, it won't matter how much money I have in the bank, and it won't matter what kind of house that I lived in or how much money I had or what clothes that I wear. But what may matter is that along the line I taught somebody how to read. And thanks to the extraordinary effort of 300 Minnesota State employees, about 7,000 children in the city of St. Paul have had that experience of being motivated to read for pleasure by Minnesota state law, by Minnesota state employees. The volunteers come from the Minnesota Judicial Center, they come from the Attorney General's office, and they come from 20 state agencies. They read Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday for 30 minutes a day at two St. Paul schools, the St. Paul Music Academy and the Benjamin E. Mays World School. Everybody Wins provides transportation for the volunteers to arrive at the school as a group. They read as a group, and they reboard the bus, and they're back at their work site within an hour. Ooh. The Minnesota State employees volunteer their time to do this, and they have been doing this now for 16 years in the state of Minnesota. Power lunch, as Representative Mariani said, is offered at schools where children are infrequently read to by parents or guardians, and consequently, they miss exposure to the life-changing power of reading. The volunteers from the state of Minnesota motivate the students to read. They promote reading for pleasure, and they serve as positive role models for the kids who might otherwise lack support for their academic success. The teachers in the Power Lunch program report that more than 75% of their students show improvement in their comprehension, their vocabulary, their classroom reading ability, and their attention span. And as I said earlier, over 7,000 students have benefited from this program, and the volunteers over the 16 years have given approximately 41,760 hours of volunteer time. Right now, Everybody Wins, like most nonprofits, is at a stage where the funding has not been very successful. What we're seeking here is $41,000 in an appropriation which will bridge the opportunity for Everybody Wins to apply for permanent, more secure funding, which will allow the program to continue being able to serve the students in St. Paul. We are in the process now of applying for a United Way designation. That's going to take some time. We've also just received a certification from the Mentoring Partnership of Minnesota that we are an excellent nonprofit. They have two classification status, and we're right now number two, and we're moving to be outstanding mentoring organization, which will improve our chances for permanent funding. This is an opportunity to continue a program that has provided much needed service for our youth, and I would encourage and I would urge the state of Minnesota to continue this program so it might go on for another 16 years. We could double these numbers, because we believe that when a child enjoys learning and loves to read, we're building a permanent citizen that will be able to pass on that same love of reading, that same volunteer spirit, to people who come after them. And we know this for a fact, in that our first students now are 24 and 25 years old. When I encounter them on the street, the first thing that comes out of their mouth, yes, I'm still reading, and yes, I'm still volunteering my services to others. So thank you for the opportunity to present this information. I will take any questions that the committee might have.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so that I understand, this could be for Representative Mariani, too. So this bill, the $41,000, will be used to essentially provide the transportation, pay for the bus, so to speak, from my notes, to take them from the government agencies to the schools, and then and back for the year?
Madam Chairman, Madam Chair, Representative Benson, the majority of the money will go towards the transportation costs, which we provide. There's also a coordinator. We have two coordinators that coordinate the movement of 300 state employees. They work with the school, they work with the teachers, and they work with the agencies to be sure that if a student isn't there, the coordinators will contact the individual volunteer, and they won't have to come to the school that day.
Okay. Representative Benson.
Madam Chair, and Representative Mariani, could this have just as easily went to Ed Finance in this part of an education bill?
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, possibly it was referred here, I think largely on the strength or largely on the fact that this involves state employees across all different departments. As we look at the accounts, this seemed to be, there aren't the similar type of accounts within the Department of Education to do this kind of work. The department for the most part, Madam Chair and members, is a compliance monitoring entity, spending most of its time, you know, securing conformity with No Child Left Behind, providing technical assistance to superintendents and school districts. And so there isn't really anything that fits the kind of accounts that this committee has the privilege to oversee.
Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
Just the last follow-up, and it may be more of a statement. I guess my only fear is, I knew where you're headed with that, is that this would also open up members, other entities, asking the state legislature for public employees to do. I have a large DOT office in Rochester, and many reading programs. And, you know, so my only fear is that, you know, if we start something, we just need to be aware that essentially, you know, we're giving some approval of paying for public employees to be bused to a school system to be part of it's essentially an education program.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, I'm certainly sensitive to that issue. When I first spoke with Mr. Anderson, I made it clear that that I'm not interested in a ongoing, you know, state investment in this. That, given the state's involvement currently, this makes sense in terms of a one-time, you know, relationship. And again, you know, the appropriations are twofold. They're both transportation and coordinator functions. So you have to be able to have the kind of coordinating in order to. You know, properly match 300 employees with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of students. I hear you, Representative Benson. It's not my intent to create a set of unintended consequences. It's certainly, in my mind, within the history and the relationship of the state to be able to effectively use nonprofits in order to promote good social policy, and I think within that, this seems to be an appropriate request.
Madam Chair, question of the Chair.
Representative Benson.
Where are we going with this, as far as this bill? Is it being laid over for possible inclusion? Or?
That's correct.
Thank you.
No further questions.
Any other questions? Well, Representative Mariani, I, too, was puzzled. Who has paid for this program for the last 16 years? Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chairman, yes. The Everybody Wins program has been absorbing the cost of transporting the volunteers for the last 16 years. We have received some partial funding from the schools. The principals have a small fund of money that they can use at their discretion. And our two principals have used that discretion to partially offset the cost of funding that we incur. We were informed by both principals at the beginning of this year that this is the last year that they can actually have that discretionary pool of money available. So that prompted the idea that we needed to find more secure funding. In that this program is our oldest program, we wanted to make sure that it got started. So we're going to find a way to keep it going, and if that would help our funding other programs, because no longer do we have to absorb this cost, at least for 2 years.
Representative Mariani, mm-hmm. I think that this bill came to this committee because
you want to take a minute.
You're requesting money from the Humanities Center, and the Humanities Center has is one of our smallest commissions or centers or accounts that we have, and the Humanities Commission receives like $400,000 for all of their activities from this committee, and so $41,000 is a huge amount for a grant from that. Our committee doesn't have any spending money at all. Each account has the base. It's recommended that each account has the base, their base budget, except for a couple different three, the big accounts, revenue, MMB, administration. And I don't really know how we could find $41,000 from the Humanities Center. And Dr. O'Fallon just walked in. Do you have we're on the House File 764 now. Do you have a statement to make?
Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, it is certainly not my request ask for $41,000 from the base funding of the Minnesota Humanities Commission. That certainly is not my intent, my request. We have an unusual situation. This seemed to be the best fit to the degree that this committee might have some target room to be able to do a one-time request. I would hope that this would be at least something that the committee could look at. I obviously understand if you don't have that room that bars that kind of look. But members, it is not my intent to take $41,000 out of the base funding Minnesota Humanities Commission. It's a fine commission. I'm glad that this committee funds it. The commission has a long history in Minnesota of bringing value added to our public education system in lots of different ways. And so we felt this might be a really good fit with them given that history. But again, Madam Chair, not my intention to pull base funding out of the Minnesota Humanities Commission.
Well, if you can do anything to help our target.
Madam Chair, I am so motivated.
Any further discussion?
Well, Madam Chairman.
Representative.
This is a number that's hardly within the round-off figure of the education targets. Yeah. Just a comment.
We tried to make that suggestion last week in some ways, but that didn't happen, so... I move that 764 be possibly included in the omnibus finance bill. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion is adopted. Anybody opposed? All right.
Madam Chair, members, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much.
The minutes for the 14th meeting, March 4th, and the 15th meeting, March 6th,
Madam
are
Chair,
before us.
I move that we approve the minutes.
Representative Benson. Pardon? Oh, you don't have them. Oh, well, hold that for next time, Representative Benson. Thank you very much. We have completed the agenda for today, so this meeting is adjourned. See you Wednesday.